You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast.
Number 173, Neuroandragogy. Presentation by Kristen Betts. That teaser was a piece called Winter Moon by Rhonda Lawrence. It's from the New Age Viola album Winter Moon. Seems appropriate because of all the extreme winter weather we've been having. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all of the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. Before we get started on the main topic today, I wanted to give a plug for the U-Sciences eLearning 3.0 conference, which is being held this May 14th, 2019. We're in the midst of call for presenters, so if you would like to present at this conference, this year the conference theme is the future of learning platforms. In fact, we have a great speaker. Our keynote presenter will be Phil Hill, who will be presenting on the future of e-learning platforms. So, of course, I'll have a link in my show notes, but please check it out. The site is usciences.edu/elearningconference. So I have a very special presentation for you this month. I'm very happy to be able to share with you a keynote talk from our recent PADLA annual conference and expo. The keynote was by Dr. Kristen Betts, and it's called Neuroandragogy, the Science and Art of Changing the Brain. Kristen is a clinical professor at Drexel University School of Education. She discusses neuroplasticity, metacognition, functional fixedness, andragogy, neurodiversity, universal design for learning, differentiated instruction, and neuroandragogy. So that discussion was a great background for illustrating how she uses these techniques in teaching her own courses. Drexel University's Conquer Collaborative is very interesting, and I'll have a link to that on my show notes. They're using a technology called FNIR, Functional Near-Infrared Spectroscopy, which is an optical brain imaging technique that enables continuous, non-invasive, and portable monitoring of changes in cerebral oxygenation related to learning. So without further ado, here's my full recording of Dr. Betts' presentation. By the way, if you are listening to this, there's also a YouTube version of it, and there'll certainly be a link on my show notes.
I'm Dr. Kristen Betts, and I would like to welcome you to this presentation on Neuroandragogy, the Science and Art of Changing the Brain. I am a clinical professor in the School of Education at Drexel University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This slide provides information about my professional background, as well as research areas of interest. If you would like, at the end of this presentation, you can go back and review the information on this slide. We'll begin the presentation by looking at neuroplasticity. We'll then go through a series of important topics, and the presentation will culminate by focusing on neuroandragogy. We'll start with the book NeuroTeach. The very first statement in this book says teachers are brain changers. So this brings about two questions. How do we know this? And why is this important? Well, we'll look at it through the lens of science. When we look at the term neuroplasticity as defined by the University of Queensland, it states, the phenomenon of neurons and neural networks modifying their connections and our behavior in response to new information, sensory stimulation, development, damage, or dysfunction. There's a wonderful video on YouTube in which Dr. Laura Boyd talks about neuroplasticity. She is with the University of British Columbia, and at the end of this presentation, you're encouraged as homework to go back and watch this video in full.
What we know about the brain is changing at a breathtaking pace. And much of what we thought we knew and understood about the brain turns out to be not true or incomplete. Now, some of these misconceptions are more obvious than others. For example, we used to think that after childhood, the brain did not, really could not change. And it turns out that nothing could be farther from the truth. Another misconception about the brain is that you only use parts of it at any given time and silent when you do nothing. Well, this is also untrue. It turns out that even when you're at rest and thinking of nothing, your brain is highly active. So it's been advances in technology such as MRI that's allowed us to make these and many other important discoveries. And perhaps the most exciting, the most interesting and transformative of these discoveries is that every time you learn a new fact or skill, you change your brain.
So we'll now look at neuroplasticity through another lens. Dr. Michael Valenzuela, who is with the University of Sydney, shares information as well about neuroplasticity. Again, for homework, you have the option of going back and watching this video in full.
Neuroplasticity refers to all those complex changes that occur in the brain in response to a big change out there in the real world. So for example, if we're to start learning yoga for the first time, or drive a car, or a new language, all of that leads to a cascade of changes in the brain, starting at the molecular level, going up to changes between cells, or even chunks of the brain communicating with other chunks of the brain in a new and more efficient way.
So as we look at the definitions that have been provided, as well as how neuroplasticity has been described, we know that your brain changes every time you learn a new fact or skill, and in response to a change in the real world or a new experience. Therefore, as educators, we need to look at our courses, not simply as courses and lesson plans, but we need to look at the dynamic learning environments we are developing and look at the series of experiences we are creating for our students in our classrooms across all modalities. We know through practice that we are actually able to change the brain. So as you'll see here, it's through neural pathways and through practice that we're able to create these synapses and these eureka moments where students are not only learning, but they're able to apply what they're learning across real-world contexts. One of the most critical aspects of learning is metacognition. How do we help students become aware of their own selves in terms of being a thinker and a learner? So this critical awareness goes down to understanding the lessons, the outcomes, and how they can transfer learning as they're introduced to new content, new skills, and engaged in new experiences. As educators, we need to think about how we're approaching our classrooms, our course design. So we need to think about what are we doing in terms of instruction and course design? How are we approaching learning and transfer of learning in our courses? Again, through course development and instruction. And do we have any blind spots? Are we experiencing functional fixedness? When we look at functional fixedness, and it's easy to look at this through the lens of students coming into the classroom who may have prior learning in a certain area, they may have certain deficits because of academic experiences that perhaps they have not been exposed to. So they're coming into the classes eager to learn, but sometimes this comes with cognitive bias. But we need to look at ourselves in terms of metacognition and identify our areas of strength, as well as our own tendency to possibly use the same applications, the same practices, the same strategies. So again, we need to look at ourselves as practitioners. So from a student perspective, looking at blindness to alternate functions, as McCaffrey talks about functional fixedness being a classical inhibitor to problem solving. What are we doing as instructors and instructional designers or professional development administrators to really address this. Our goal is to look at the optimization of learning across modalities and learning environments and through pedagogy and andragogy. So you'll see here a link to a short video that'll introduce you to the concept of functional fixedness. Right now, we'll look at this statement. Is it a myth or is it a fact? Individuals learn better when they receive information in their preferred learning styles. Well, the answer is incorrect. This is probably one of the most prevalent neuromyths in K through 12 and higher education. We do know that students have preferred learning styles. They may have a preference, but if we teach to preferred learning styles, we create almost a fixed mindset where we're not exposing students to different modalities of learning. And it's critical that we are optimizing the learning environments, the activities in which we're engaging students, so they don't have a fixed mindset as they're engaged in different problems throughout their lives and throughout their careers. There was an article published in 2006 that put together a learning style challenge and offered $5,000 for anybody that could provide evidence that it is best to instruct in alignment with learning styles. To date, nothing is paid out. So why is this important? Well, research shows that an educator's conceptualization of knowledge can impact her or his pedagogy, and this in turn can affect a learner's epistemological beliefs. So we want to make sure that we are debunking our own neuromyths, misconceptions, misunderstandings, and we need to support this through evidence-based practices. When we look at this statement by Alvin Toffler, the illiterate of the 21st century will not be those who cannot read and write, but those who cannot learn, unlearn, and relearn. And this is critically important in terms of metacognition and the human learning process. So again, learn, unlearn, and relearn. So with this, we're going to look at the art. How do we actually change the brain as instructional designers, instructors, and professional development administrators? Well, this is going to require a new mindset in order to get to new results. It's a concept of going from good to great to exceptional. So we'll start with andragogy. As defined by Malcolm Knowles, it is the art and science of teaching adults. And you'll see the difference here between pedagogy and andragogy. Although you will often see pedagogy really is almost an umbrella that is used to cover both within the literature. When we look at really the history of the terminology, you'll see it comes from child, which is a pados, and then leader of, the agogos, or man, which is the andros. So with adult learners, one of the things that we need to really think about and embrace, which is probably one of the most exciting elements of our classrooms, is the fact that all of our learners are different. It's something called neurodiversity. Diversity of human brains and minds. When we look at universal design for learning, while many people think about UDL being associated with accessibility, it's really built upon what is defined here by CAST, to improve and optimize teaching and learning for all people based on scientific insights into how humans learn. So of course, access is critical. Accessibility is critical. If you look at any of the research by Tom Toblin, you'll see this critical, important aspect of access. But really, when we drill down, how humans learn. When we look at differentiated instruction, we aren't looking at creating different lesson plans or individualized assignments based on learners or even learning styles. What we're looking at is differentiated instruction, understanding that within our classrooms, we have diverse learners. Each student is unique in terms of the experiences that they bring in terms of the knowledge and where they are at that point in the classroom, very much like Vygotsky's work on zone of proximal development. So we want to make sure that we develop assignments where we do integrate in choice. So if there's a project, if we can integrate in choice, we have the opportunity for students to deconstruct and reconstruct learning, knowledge, skills, and experiences that align with what is familiar with them in terms of interests, relevance, which is going to support transfer of learning across real-world contexts. Again, looking at UDL, we're looking at multiple means of engagement, representation, and action and expression, which is really the why, the what, and the how. I'm going to share just a couple of examples of before and after assignments or ways that we've approached learning within our program, the EDD program at Drexel University. EDUC 815 is a course that looks at advanced writing within a doctoral program. Students are coming in. When we look at this course in terms of differentiated instruction, students have a choice of topics. They're able to actually not simply identify a topic, but it has to align with real-world problems that they're going to be researching and investigating. And there has to be relevance, current or their future position. So where students are right now and where they plan to go. Originally, this assignment simply focused on identifying a research topic. Now we've aligned it with choice, interest, and relevance. The final paper is also scaffolded. Originally, the assignment was due at the end of the 10 weeks, and the paper is 15 to 20 pages long. The challenge is students would work on this paper throughout the 10 weeks, submit it at the end, and they would get feedback in week 10. Well, by then the course was over, and they weren't able to actually integrate in the feedback, which is so important to learning, unlearning, relearning. It's critical for metacognition, reflection, and actually reapplying what you've learned or relearned. So we actually took the paper and broke it into three assignments. So again, looking at the assignment, not simply as one paper, but multiple papers, and then we completely transformed our discussion boards. So students were engaged with elements of a written paper, but through multiple modalities. Again, multiple means. We engage them in individual work, peer work, and we really focus on creativity and how to align that with writing. So again, we took apart these pieces, the deconstruction for the construction and reconstruction. So we're looking at constructivism and social constructivism. We're also looking at transformative learning, providing students with that challenge, that dilemma, or that cognitive conflict to approach an assignment through a different lens, addressing that functional fixedness. So again, when we look at multiple means and we look at practice and feedback, much like going into, let's say, the woods, if there is no path, you can walk that path the first time and you may be able to see something. You walk it again a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth time, but it's through practice. Just like we talked about, learning, unlearning, and relearning, engagement, representation, action, and expression, that we're able to create these neural pathways, these dynamic networks where learning is taking place and we are actually physically changing the brain. And it is through practice and feedback that this occurs. So in 815, students have to actually create annotations, and it's so important because they have to have critical writing skills. For many students, they may come in, and one of the challenges is negative transfer. They may be experts in MLA or another style of writing. They come in, they begin writing. APA is what we use in the program. So while they're transferring these skills very easily, unfortunately, it's not APA. So we have an assignment in the week 2 discussion board. They have to post two sets of annotations. Now, this assignment actually aligns perfectly with what is due in week 5, which is 15 completed annotations. So in the discussion board, they have to post two annotations, and that week is focused on helping your peers post perfect annotations. So as students post, they have to go in and review the posts of their peers and identify where their peers may need additional modifications. So again, or corrections, the enhancing or that unlearning and relearning. There is a specific set in terms of word count for the summary, the assessment, and the reflection. They also have a certain protocol that they must follow. So as they go through, they help their peers identify changes that they need to make. They then go back and even make changes to their own posts. By the end of that week, I go in, I make additional recommendations for change, and they get graded on their final post, which is a culmination of all of the updates that they've made. In the online environment, while we may not have the opportunity to walk around the classroom, the discussion boards provide an incredible opportunity to walk around that classroom, see what students are working on, just as you would in a classroom, and provide very structured and intentional feedback customized for that student that peers are also able to benefit from. So the discussion board then provides that opportunity for practice and space learning as they prepare for that week 5 assignment. We also have taken and completely transformed what used to be looking at an outline. We would ask students to provide a text outline of what they see as their research streams. The challenge was many students would ask, how would you like this developed? They might write questions instead of actual research topics. So we have reconceptualized this. And in week 4, the students create a concept map. They have to identify each of their streams and then underneath the supporting areas of literature. And what we have found is they post this in the discussion board. I, as the instructor, am able to walk around in the classroom just as you would in a class where students are working. I can provide feedback, and students provide feedback for one another. Again, students have time to practice. They take all of the feedback, they reconceptualize that, reflect on it, deconstruct and reconstruct it for a final post in week 4. This then gets turned into what is their actual text outline going towards the paper. Again, another example of how a student approached the same assignment. When we look at week 5, students actually have to go in and look at real dissertations. They go into ProQuest and they identify dissertations that align with their research interests. They then go in with a rubric and they have to reflect on the different components of Chapter 2, which is a literature review. Not only do they go through and really kind of review with this rubric, but they have to go into VoiceThread and provide to their peers, because they're assigned to a group where students are involved in similar research, and they have to walk their peers through their review of these different dissertations and identify their strengths or areas that they've identified that they want to make sure they're either providing more context or more information. Again, the opportunity to reflect, look at real-world practice, and then apply this as they move forward. What we've done is we've made sure that the rubric that they're working with is part of their upcoming review and a future submission as well. The students pull together their papers through Padlet. So instead of simply having them write their papers, in weeks 6 and 7, within their groups where they're working in shared areas of research where they have commonalities with research interests, they are actually breaking down what will become their paper. They have to introduce their research topic. They have to talk about the significance of the research, their problem statement, the purpose of the research, what are the research questions, and you'll see how nicely they've integrated in the work from week 4, which is the concept map, their literature review map. So they work for 2 weeks and they provide each other with feedback in terms of the writing within each of these sections. Again, as the instructor, I'm able to go in, I go through the discussion boards and through a 2-week period of time, and we intentionally have set this up for 2 weeks to support space practice. I go in, I provide feedback. Students have to provide feedback either through text, voice, or video. The students take screenshots of the changes or as well as the comments that were shared so they can reflect on that as they continue to make their changes. And at the end of week 7, they present their Padlet with their draft of how they'll break down their paper. As they go through, they finish and they write a paper, but they create what's called an e-poster, which really aligns with what you would see at any conference in terms of an e-poster. These e-posters are then brought together, and I'll show you in a minute what they look like. Again, as they're preparing this, they're working on their paper. The paper as described is broken down instead of simply being a single submission at week 10. The first paper focuses on the first part of the paper, and this is due in week 4. You'll see that the second paper is due in week 7. This gives them adequate time to go back and reflect on the changes. And when they submit paper 2, they actually have to submit all of the updates based on paper 1. So paper 2 is a culmination of the first submission with all of the changes based on faculty feedback. When they turn in the third paper, which is the largest paper, they've gone back and they've made changes based on feedback for paper 1 and paper 2. Supporting reflection, supporting metacognition, and ensuring that they're developing those skills. So if they're a student that originally came into the course writing very long clauses for that opening statement that might be 3, 4, 5, or 6 lines long, they've gone back, they've learned, unlearned, and relearned how to write this paper for the literature review. Again, all of this culminates in a final project. When we look at feedback, feedback is given throughout the course. Rubrics are used, and within the rubrics, you'll see there are text comments. You'll see here, Vocaroo is used to provide voice comments. Students are told if they would like to have a transcript of anything that it is available. So the text comments are provided. Peer comments are also provided through multiple modalities. You may have additional modalities that are provided. The very first paper that I give back has video comments. So in addition to the text comments, I walk students through their papers page by page to make sure that they understand exactly what my expectations are, what the changes are that I'm looking for, and I want them to hear the intonation in my voice, the excitement about their research, in areas that they need to focus on. The second paper, I provide text feedback as well as voice feedback, and the last paper is simply text feedback. It all comes together to support transfer of learning. So when we look at this and we look at research that we're doing at Drexel University, in 8:15, we looked at a course that is really a writing course, but uses multiple modalities, building upon the sciences of learning, looking at the art of how we engage students through multiple modalities. We bring together writing that is broken down through concept maps, looking at technology, and culminates in what is e-poster, a showcase at the end, which is a project, but it has been part of the writing process. When we look at Drexel University in terms of research where we're focusing on transfer of learning, there's something called the Drexel University Conquer Collaborative. They are doing exceptional research related to FNIR measurements, looking at oxygenation of the brain in terms of learning. On the left, you'll see a project. One of my PhD students that I'm working with right now has developed a video application. Students are going in, and she's actually looking at transfer of learning. The students complete a series of activities, and we're going back and looking at these measurements. You'll also see here, we are working on a transdisciplinary project at Drexel University. It involves the School of Education, biomedical engineering, the College of Nursing and Health Professions, and also media arts and design. And we have taken a paper-based assessment, which is a Purdue assessment looking at spatial visualization. And we actually took all of the incoming biomedical engineering students, and we did a number of assessments in fall of 2017, looking at non-cognitive factors, and we did a reassessment in spring of 2018. We also did the assessment in the fall with the Purdue Spatial Visualization Assessment, which is a paper-based test, and then we did it again in the spring. However, we created an intervention. We took this paper-based assessment and turned it into an immersive virtual reality application. So you'll see me here with the immersive virtual reality headset on and also with the FNIR device. And this is what we created. We had students come in and they actually went through this presentation or through the application, and they were able to pick up what was on the paper-based test and look at each of the blocks from a three-dimensional perspective. So they came in through a series of weeks and they practiced with this. So we're actually doing comparative research looking at students who are part of a control and weren't engaged in the immersive virtual reality application compared to the students that were. What is the impact in terms of the Purdue assessment? Did it increase performance? And how did this affect the non-cognitive factors as well? So when we look at neuroandragogy, we're actually looking at, again, bringing together the science and the art of how we develop our learning environments and how we develop pedagogy or andragogy in terms of teaching. So it's informing instruction with advancements in neuroplasticity, building upon really that intersection of the neurosciences, psychology, education, and then also trying to disrupt functional fixedness, focusing on metacognition, being very intentional. How do we scaffold in practice? How do we integrate spacing so students have time to practice, put it down, reflect, and go back? How do we look at UDL in terms of multiple means of engagement? What are we doing in terms of feedback? How are we providing feedback in terms of peer feedback, instructor feedback, and even working with students so they're able to review their own materials in terms of self-reflection? And then lastly, looking at how do we customize learning, really almost adaptive learning, looking at neurodiversity and differentiated instruction. And lastly, but most important, how do we bring curricula to life in our classrooms across all modalities to support real-world transfer across multiple contexts? There's a number of wonderful books that you'll see, starting with James Zoll, The Art of Changing the Brain, all the way through a new book coming out in 2019, looking at the five pillars of the mind. As we conclude this presentation, we need to really embrace and be excited about the current and emerging research that is out there within the learning sciences and really focus on the fact that educators are brain changers. From instructors to instructional designers to administrators, we have the amazing opportunity to create these dynamic learning environments and to create these learning experiences that are changing lives and changing brains. Thank you so much for being a part of this presentation. And if you have any questions, please reach out to me by email.
So that's it for this month. I hope you enjoyed the presentation. Don't forget, if you wanted to see the visuals, I recommend that you go into my YouTube channel where you'll see the essentially like a voiceover PowerPoint plus some videos that are inserted. So don't forget to stay tuned for the full song Winter Moon by Rhonda Lawrence. Until next time, have a great week. Thank you.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog or send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.